Good evening, everyone. This is episode 201 of Certar Podcast. And within that, we reached the final episode of COVID Conversations, a mini-series I produce along with British Council Hungary with the support of the Embassy of the United Kingdom here in Budapest. In this series, we invite Hungarian and British scientists to explore various aspects of the pandemics. Just to sum it up briefly, what we had before, in the first episode, we were examining how smart the virus really is with evolutionary biologist Orsolya Bayer-Molnár. Then we looked at the Collecting Pandemics project with Roger Highfield, the science director of the Science Museum Group in London. We were also looking at the changes in the social pattern with network scientist and sociologist Balázs Vedrás of Oxford University. And last week, we discussed basically everything about vaccines with Beate Kampmann, director of the Vaccine Center at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. If you missed any of these shows, you can find them conveniently either on this YouTube channel at the dedicated COVID Conversations playlist, or you can also listen to the audio format at Certar Podcast. You will certainly find the link below this video. With today's episode, we try to add a completely different perspective to this picture, and which is, there are many factors that may hinder the effectiveness of the intervention. Unquestionably, one of these factors is the torrent of misinformation. There will be two guests tonight. One of them is a computational propaganda researcher at the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University. He is Alexander Herasimenko. And our other participant tonight is Peter Krakow, social psychologist, political scientist. He's the director of Political Capital and also an associate professor at ELTE University here in Budapest. Welcome them here on the show. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Can you please, at the beginning, sum up briefly what your field of research is, especially regarding COVID and this pandemics? Maybe we can start with Alexander. I think this computational propaganda is very interesting.
Well, yes, indeed, it's quite interesting, and it's an emerging field of social science when people try to understand how algorithms, platforms, internet technologies in general contribute to spreading of propaganda, of misinformation, of disinformation, fake news. There are many names to all type of manipulative content people spread. And that's what I'm also doing. I'm part of a big team of researchers at Oxford that look at that phenomena from different perspectives, from perspective of, for instance, journalism or media, from the perspective of activism, perspective of authoritarian countries. My specialism is in manipulation of political content in non-democracies, but also in democracies across less known places, social media that are less kind of popular, less often used, and very often now is growing in audience. And in terms of COVID, our team been looking at many exciting topics related to how misinformation spreads during the COVID times, during the pandemic, how different actors try to manipulate public opinion globally across many countries, and also how platforms, how social media companies combat this type of manipulative content.
And I'm happy I recently read a very interesting publication you just made with your colleagues. So we will dig deeper in this topic in a little bit. What about you, Peter?
So first of all, thanks for having me at this event. And I'm really happy to be in one panel with Alexander. I really highly appreciate the work of the Oxford Computational Propaganda Project. So I'm looking forward to this discussion. I'm a social psychologist and a political scientist. I have an academic hat. I'm an associate professor, as you told, at ELTE University, where we are doing quite a lot of research with my colleagues around conspiracy theories, the background factors, that makes us receptive to conspiracy theories, fake news, political fake news, how our biases make us quite vulnerable to fake news. And with my colleagues at Political Capital Institute, this is my think tank hat, we have done a number of research on COVID-related disinformation on the online sphere in Hungary and in Central Eastern Europe as well, and also how populist politics destroys the trust in a lot of cases in healthcare institutions, and how COVID-related disinformation and fake news and conspiracy theories can undermine healthcare policy efforts to fight the pandemic.
You mentioned misinformation and disinformation. Am I just splitting hair here, or there is a difference between the two?
There is clearly a difference. But to be frank, in practice, it's not always easy to differentiate between two. Misinformation is the not deliberate spread of false information. I mean, if I have a wrong information about something, for example, when does the bus leave, and I tell it to someone, and I don't want to mislead the other, it's just like I have the wrong information, this is misinformation. Disinformation is something that is deliberate and intentional. So when I want to disinform someone, it's an informational lie. I want to mislead him or her. But as I said, attribution is not always easy, especially when it comes to COVID-related disinformation or misinformation.
Yeah, I also can add here that, in fact, there are more terms beyond that, right? There's also a famous term, fake news, which might not be the best one to describe it all. And also there are...
But everyone understands when you are talking about fake news, everyone has the same idea probably, or maybe as a researcher you have a different point.
Mainstream journalists don't like this term somehow. But interestingly also, there is also, of course, kind of political lies and political manipulation by politicians, right? By established politicians. And it's sort of separate universe of misinformation and disinformation. Sometimes you don't know, shall we call it misinformation, or it's just part of political game, political fight? It's also sort of difficult topic.
So what can be the motivation or the intention of these actors who try to share disinformation or fake news regarding COVID? Because I would suspect that as the pandemic affects all of us very similarly in terms of biology, maybe it's not a smart way to cause turbulence here, because that would be our common goal or common sense goal to protect ourselves from the effects of the pandemics.
Yeah, well, there are many, many, many reasons for people to spread misinformation. Sometimes they spread it deliberately, sometimes not. Sometimes they just believe in stuff that looks ridiculous. Famous case was this 5G network conspiracy that was related to the idea that 5G technology somehow might spread COVID disease, which is ridiculous, right? But some people believed it, and it resulted in damage to the network of towers, of telecommunication towers that been linked to this technology in the UK. So a number of towers been damaged by people during the first months of the pandemic. So there are many cases of how people believe or not. But interestingly, what we're looking at, to a large extent, we're looking at how misinformation spreads globally. And we're looking at, for instance, how there are a number of actors, a number of people, number of organizations that just love spreading misinformation and disinformation. And they are linked to foreign states, we call them. They're linked to countries like Russia or China or Iran. And they established networks of manipulative media that sometimes just are harmful and spread nice information that is not cannot be categorized as anything damage. Something that we cannot categorize as something that would cause any damage to social structures. But sometimes the networks they establish spread deliberately misinformation, disinformation, that they've been engaged in spreading this misinformation during pandemic, specifically Russian actors, for instance. Organizations like RT, Sputnik, found that they've been involved in that type of actions. And why they do it? Some people say very simply, because they tried to prompt mistrust, to sort of damage trust of citizens in their governments, whatever political.
But that can also have a backlash, don't you think? But this can also, this attitude or this action can also have a backlash later on, when there is so much distrust that people will not know which source to trust or not.
Exactly. Maybe it's, some actors want. They want to spread this mistrust, spread this chaos, political chaos in a way. And in that chaos, more radical forces might emerge.
Yes, but people also need to be susceptible to these different conspiracy theories. But as I read a recent study of political capital, I could also see, according to your data, Peter, that the attitude of people in different countries, even in countries that share fairly similar attitudes in many sense, for instance, in the V4 countries here in Central Europe, the landscape here is quite different from country to country, how much people account to these informations.
Yeah, one thought about the source of this information, so the supply side, because I think it's really important. And as Alexander also mentioned, there are many players on the disinformation field, and I think it's important to know that there are a lot of actors out there that want to mislead us, and we shouldn't think that we ourselves are not receptive to disinformation, conspiracy theories. Everyone is. So it has some connection to education. It has some connection to intelligence, but these are very, very weak correlations. And generally, what we can see most of the studies is if you have strong biases, for example, political biases, but everyone has biases, these are really easy to exploit via disinformation. And there are domestic political players, and as Alexander said, who are spreading disinformation deliberately for political purposes. I mean, right now, I think a very obvious example, let's look at what happens in the United States and who is spreading mainly the disinformation that the election was fake and fraudulent. You don't need Russia for that right now. You don't need Iran. You don't need China. There is the president of the United States who is doing the job. So it can bring political benefits. It can push away the responsibility. And also it can mobilize his voter base. So and COVID-related disinformation is also, I think, spread in a lot of countries in Europe as well by leaders of populist right-wing parties who have some interest in spreading this let's say anti-establishment narrative. There are foreign actors out there, as Alexander said, and also there are more and more players. I mean, we know it from the studies of the Oxford Computational Propaganda Project that there are dozens of states that are spreading this information to their own citizens, but also they export it to gain more leverage in intentional politics. There are celebrities who are sometimes spreading COVID-related disinformation because it's like, you know, if you want more clicks, then it's a good way to do that. And there are clickbait disinformation sites, like, let's say, Your News Wire.
Motivation.
Yes, absolutely. And Alex Jones's InfoWar and so on, because disinformation, it spreads quickly. It raises your attention. It results in clicks and results in advertisement revenues. And to add to all that, this is something more difficult to track. And there are just a few examples, but big companies can be sources of disinformation as well. As it was revealed a few times, for example, the fossil fuel industry in some cases were behind some disinformation against the green energies and so on. So there are a whole lot of players out there who want to mislead us. And everyone, and I think, of course, we can blame them and we have to blame them. We have to name and shame them and try to let's say, call out for stop these activities, but it won't stop. And what is pretty important is what you just mentioned, Laszlo, is that, I mean, there are, in every countries we have different patterns of what kind of disinformation we are receptive to. And for example, in Poland, it's not the same what works than in Hungary. In Slovakia, let's say, political disinformation spread, for example, by Russia, have quite different characteristics than spread in Hungary. So there are country-specific characteristics. There are even, I mean, more smaller groups than that in different countries. And more, I think, disinformation becomes more sophisticated. It becomes more micro-targeted. And there, I think there is the end of the big meta-narratives. Like now, right now, I think we are entering into an era. And of course, social media opens huge avenues and possibilities for that, when almost everyone can be deceived in different forms. So I think what the first and important thing is to recognize that everyone is vulnerable and whole societies are vulnerable, and it's not just them, not just the other political side, not just the stupid, not just the other members of other countries who are vulnerable. Everyone is vulnerable.
We'll talk about the role of the social media platforms. But before that, I'm always thinking of how this whole process starts when there is a new event emerging, like a COVID pandemic. Is there like a conspiracy think tank that sit together and start to brainstorm how to invent the most ridiculous conspiracy theories? Or do you know anything about the birth of this process?
Well, either of you. We know something. We don't know everything. And there are different sort of processes happening when conspiracy emerges. I think what is common for popular conspiracies is that they're often a result, a reaction to some social issue, some social problem. So as COVID became such a huge issue, people who are involved in producing those conspiracies, they just focus on it. They reflect what they're thinking, what society is worried about, and they just do it. There are a number of, not think tanks, but maybe organizations that involved in production, but often it's just sort of co-production networks that emerge that just consist of ordinary users that contribute one by one, and it's growing quite fast as a result.
Okay, on the speed of the spread of all this information, you, Alexander, recently published a very interesting study with your colleagues. I'll try to quote a few remarks here. The title was COVID-related misinformation on YouTube, if you remember this topic very recently. It said, "It took YouTube on average 41 days to remove videos containing false information." 41 days. Second statement, "COVID-related misinformation videos do not find their audience through YouTube itself, but largely by being shared on Facebook." Number three, "Facebook placed warning labels about false information only on less than 1% of the misinformation videos shared on the platform." And if you want to think of it nominally, what an incredibly huge number this is. Misinformation videos were shared almost 20 million times on social media, which is more than the shares gathered by the five largest English language news sources on YouTube combined. That's mind-blowing. What do we even want to do here? This battle is lost. That's what I feel from reading these.
Oh, well, don't be discouraged from pursuing battle for truth. I think it's not lost. I think, first of all, of course, we mentioned that 40 days, about 40 days, it's time when YouTube really looking at those videos that might be conspiracies, might be hate, spreading videos, but mostly about COVID indeed. But sometimes it's just a couple of days, yeah? And especially if they are fast-growing types of content. So it really depends on the case. It's kind of, we provided the landscape, and don't forget, we've been looking at sort of global audiences, and there are billions of people who use internet, right? So which means that if been even shared millions of times, it still means that many people didn't share anything like that. It's been moderated with time. We looked at those videos that been moderated, been removed. But indeed, there is a huge problem how to deal with this type of how platforms should approach misinformation that been spread using them. This is a huge challenge many people discuss. No, I wouldn't say there is a solution at the moment.
Okay, that would have been my next question. What do you think the solution could be, or what your suggestions would be to be more aware of this situation? I don't know if you can
continue with that. I'll maybe contribute.
Okay, Peter said in one of his interviews recently that there has to be a demand to fake news. So there is a social demand for receiving conspiracy theories.
Yes, exactly. And I think you raise a very important question. Where do conspiracy theories birth and how? And I think this is an under-investigated aspect, because we either tend to think that these are, let's say, these born spontaneously, and in some cases they do. So what I mean, one important aspect of conspiracy theories in a lot of cases is that they want to explain the world, they want to explain new phenomenon. And yes, it's especially when COVID was something that is just appearing in the world stage and nobody knew what is it about. They haven't experienced something like that. It just and it's invisible. It more or less natural that there are new explanations around there, and there is a collective brainstorming in the society for better or for worse. Unfortunately, usually more for worse. But there is a demand for this kind of theories, and that's why we, in a lot of cases, cannot really decide if these are, let's say, ordinary citizens that are trying to brainstorm about what's happening in the world, or political campaign consultants running new narratives, or FSB operatives running new narratives in the global information ecosystem. But what is known for sure is that, according to most studies, disinformation market is mostly elite driven. So the most influential disinformation is either comes from politicians or from states or from celebrities. And there are a lot more information out there, but the ones that are really making a huge impact on the public opinion are usually coming from the top. But of course, the reason why they can be so popular is that they are fulfilling some kind of popular demand, explaining the world, putting the blame on the wellness. I mean, if you think that, for example, the COVID-19 was not born by practically accident, it was not something natural, but there is a superpower who you hate anyway, and they created in their military lab, and they spread it in the world, or that Bill Gates is spreading that if you are an anti-capitalist, and the list goes on and on. So conspiracy theories and disinformation usually target your already existing enemies and exploit your already existing stereotypes, plus give a comfortable explanation to the world. Even if they are scary, at least you have the illusion that you can explain what's happening around you. And this is a big advantage in itself. But but as it was said already, you don't have the same kind of demand in every country. So there is a huge variety. And for example, if
is
we are looking
based on education or the education system,
education, but on culture as well. And there are conspiracy theories, for example, around about UFOs or about let's say, the QAnon conspiracy theory that, I mean, it does not really resonate to a European
audience. Let me share a very popular one from Hungary, that Hungarian ancestors came from Sirius, which we all know, of course.
Yes, of course. And when it comes to COVID-related conspiracy theories, but Alexander mentioned the 5G conspiracy theories, they exist in Hungary, but these are not really... really strong. And in the Anglo-Saxon world, I think they are much more influential than in Hungary. For example, we have a different set of conspiracy universe in Hungary.
Looking at the patterns from previous conspiracy theories, can you, as scientists, predict what the next conspiracy theory would be? Not specifically now, but do you have the tools to predict?
Oh, wow. I don't know. I can't. But I think what we can predict, in fact, is emergence of important social issue based on the growing conspiracy theories. So we monitor in the UK, we look at many social media platforms, many, many popular platforms, live time, and we try to understand what's going on there in terms of conspiracies. And when we see that some specific conspiracy is growing, specifically related, for instance, to some issue that can be exploited by radical political actors, we might easily see emergence of offline action after it. For instance, as I mentioned, 5G first emerged as offline, or is online conspiracy, and then it became an offline issue, technology being damaged, right? But then, for instance, when people start spreading misinformation about masks, saying, I don't know, mask can give you COVID, in a couple of weeks, we can easily see protests, anti-mask protests, people demanding stop, indicate there is the policy that you need to wear a mask. So we can predict certain things, but I can't really see how we can, unfortunately, imagine what's going to happen in terms of this conspiracy market next. It will be difficult. I don't know, maybe Peter has any insight into this.
No, I unfortunately can't. I think it's an excellent question again. But what we think for sure, what we know for sure, is what Alexander says, that if there is something novel happening in the society, something unexpected, a virus, a catastrophe, let's say a murder or a terrorist attack or something like that, you will have a lot of conspiracy theories circulating around. And the classics of the social scientists who were doing research on rumors, they identify the situation that creates a fertile ground for rumors, or we can say disinformation, conspiracy theories as well. And these are the situations that are important for the society. So everyone is affected, or a lot of people are affected. And the other thing is, there is some information ambiguity out there. Either there is lack of information, or as it is usually in our time, there is too much information and contradicting information. Let's imagine how many messages we've heard about should we wear masks or not. And at the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of politicians, for tactical
reasons, even from official sources, we got contradicting information.
Absolutely, yes. For tactical reasons. I mean, there was a shortage of masks, and a lot of decision makers thought that it's a better idea to say that it doesn't really matter. And then they had to contradict themselves. Mm. And this kind of contradictory information is really something that is fueling conspiracy theories. And then conspiracy theories themselves, also, as Alexander says, they are. Not just following the important events, that they are shaping them. I mean, as we can see in the United States and many other countries, in countries where COVID-related disinformation was on the rise, the COVID cases were on the rise as well. So COVID skepticism just boosted the COVID itself and made the virus much more serious and much more deadly than it would have originally been.
This might repeat itself in Hungary, at least, maybe, or I'm not sure about this, but a recent study suggests that nearly half of the Hungarians would refuse a COVID vaccine, even if it is available. Can this be put on the account of fake news or misinformation?
Yeah, well, I actually now we are trying to study vaccination process, which is very interesting situation. And in fact, what at least been happening in many English speaking countries, because you know English unites not just one country, yeah, it's not just one about one society. People who speak English, they sort of consume news that can be produced elsewhere, right, in any other country. What we've seen is there was something called vaccine hesitancy movement emerging for last 10, 15 years in the US. And it gradually been spreading to other countries as well, including UK, for instance, and perhaps Europe as well. And it might actually explain something. So it's not really about conspiracy, that there are many of them, many. We have, I think, a list of about 200 sources, just in English, that spread anti-vaccination, misinformation, and disinformation every day. No, not every day, but at least they publish something once a week or something like that, yeah? But there are many people who just really, really hesitant about vaccination. They could be very well informed. In fact, they could know subject much better than ordinary people, ordinary person who might be interested or might just take vaccine if they've been told. And also, of course, there are also people who really think about that very carefully, but also people who've been affected, maybe, or heard about stories related to vaccination. And of course, the people who consume misinformation and disinformation. But so it just shows that this landscape is very complex. There is no one answer how to deal with that and how to convince people to take vaccine. If it's available, it's not yet available even.
Yes, and I think the research that you referred to, Laszlo, it's a series of public opinion polls in countries in the world by Ipsos that unfortunately found the latest report that was released in November found that there is a growing skepticism towards the COVID vaccine in the whole world. And I think it's partially the reason for that is that there is no vaccine. There is still no vaccine. So it's like people even who would like to have the vaccine cannot vaccinate themselves. And this frustration can easily turn to rejection. But I think two other reasons for that. One is, yes, COVID skeptic disinformation. And we have this, let's say, doctor celebrities in Hungary as well, who are just arguing against the masks and says that COVID is practically non-existent or it's not even as serious as a flu, and the list goes on and on. Plus, there are many people who just don't want to go to a next total lockdown, and they want to live their life as they lived before. And if you want to live your life and you live your life as you lived before, then you have to justify it by claiming that, you know, it's not a big thing. And I would say the third set of reasons for why COVID skepticism is on the rise is the huge, disinformation operations that Russia and China are running at the moment. And in Hungary, for example, I'm not so happy that the government is so enthusiastic about the Russian and Chinese vaccine. If you take a look at the polls, Hungarians do not trust neither the Chinese nor the Russian vaccine. And if we look at the scientific results, probably there is a reason for that. Still, if the governments are just pushing them, then I think they are just fueling the already existing skepticism. And there are a lot of fears over a new vaccine, partially understandable. It's something new. There will be side effects, of course. We don't know when and from which direction it will arrive. What we can hope is that if the vaccine will be here, then this theoretic rejection of a vaccine might turn into something, a more practical, pragmatic approach of, okay, let's try, even if it doesn't help too much, let's just try that. But I have serious concerns about that. And I think it's pretty much welcome what happens in the UK. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there is a task force that was created by the government that are tracking and try to respond to the flood of disinformation, COVID-related and vaccine-related disinformation. I think something like that would be pretty much welcome in Hungary as well.
In fact, yeah, that's correct regarding the UK, but it's also interesting about Hungary, because Hungary is quite unusual case in this respect, because I think most countries look at Russian vaccine with a bit of suspicion, yeah? And one of the reasons is that how Russia approaches this topic. In contrast to other countries, for instance, in UK, if you listen to their government, they kind of getting ready to cure the world, you know, to stop COVID with their vaccine all around the world. But what Russia is doing, I think it's kind of using vaccine topic as sort of geopolitical tool to combat, to remind the world how great Russia is. And in the narratives, Russian media use to advertise it and also to diminish other vaccines is also quite quite disturbing, in fact, yeah. China, in fact, is not that active. We didn't hear much from about Chinese vaccines, kind of.
In Hungary, we hear some, but I think, yeah, you're right that the Russian, let's say, vaccine campaign is much louder. On the G20 meeting, Putin has just announced that Russia is the world leader in developing and producing vaccines. Why? I mean, this is pretty ironic because, first of all, Sputnik V vaccine was authorized by the Russian authorities before the first phase of testing was finished, which is pretty unusual and pretty dangerous as well. First thing. Second thing, the Russian healthcare system is collapsing under the current COVID vaccine. And third thing, Russia does not have enough production capacities to provide vaccines to the world. Still, the narrative is that we could cure everyone in the world. It's just like, you know, the evil Brussels bureaucrats doesn't let our vaccine in the European Union. It's just totally misleading, and it's something that I think should be approached with a lot of suspicion. And the problem with that, I think, is that this whole, let's say, contradictory information around the vaccines, I think, can, let's say, destroy the general trust in the vaccination process.
Yeah, but this is already seen at many other fields, how we approach different vaccination techniques or procedures. When you said Sputnik V, I thought that was Sputnik 5, but maybe the V stands for Vladimir. I'm not sure. So sorry for this joke. But right. Also, there is a fairly sarcastic or very interesting approach that Moni gave us, that it's interesting that there is no such hesitance on the field of smoking or obesity. So maybe it's also the topic that makes people susceptible to fake news or misinformation?
Well, in fact, with vaccination, it's very curious. We've been looking at websites that particularly focus on, we'll call it anti-vax narratives. So this type of narratives that highlight that vaccine might be dangerous, so don't take it. You know what are those people behind? We try to understand who are behind those type of websites. There's just tiny websites in English, not very big, not much content. And we found that many of those people behind those websites apparently are also owners of small businesses or big businesses selling so-called alternative medicine products, all sorts of herbal stuff. So, in fact, they try to convince people that vaccine don't work and general medicine doesn't work, but we have a solution for you. Before trusting those people, consult your doctor and... Yeah, they have a good advice, I believe, better than those people. So, in fact, people try to earn money on misinformation.
Can we learn? I think it's very important. Sorry, just one sentence. I think that's the most important thing here is that COVID-related disinformation adds to the already existing strong anti-science, disinformation ecosystem. And I think... the COVID is very ambivalent in the sense that I think it provides huge opportunities for scientists, doctors, and people, let's say, on the who are representing scientific information and institutions. And on the other hand, it provides unprecedented opportunities as well for the ones who want to destroy the trust in science. And as we can see in some polls, trust in science has become something more polarized as a result of the pandemic. There are, let's say, more fan of the, let's say, scientific approaches and science-based enlightened approach. And also there are more and more skeptics. And it's I think it's going to be an increasingly important topic where I think the education of science is something that, that will be crucially important in the coming decades.
It has to be changed how we approach these topics in the education system as well. But do you think we can learn anything, or can we already learn anything from the communication strategies of those who spread misinformation that could be implemented to spread the useful information or evidence-based scientific information?
That's a favorite question of policymakers, people who, in fact, design response of the government to this type of information. They ask, can we use the same sensational type of content that very often used by misinformation spreaders? Can we try to use the same type of argument construction, same type of, I don't know, sensational video style of promotion of the ideas? I think in fact, I would say this is dangerous. This is dangerous route, and it's a route that, like, in why the politics might be related to spread of populism, for instance, and sensational content. I think what's really is needed, as Peter mentioned as well, as many people agree, is of course focus on education, focus on on explanation, explaining people. For instance, people who do not trust vaccination, they just need information. We just need to talk to them honestly as scientists. But also, it's one way, but it takes time, right? It takes really a lot of time sometimes.
A very long time.
Other approach we might take to combat or address misinformation is regulatory approach, yeah? To think how we can regulate online space, because it seems to me one of the most broad field where misinformation spreads most faster than other type of content sometimes. But again, it's also difficult because websites that where misinformation flourishes, like we showed YouTube, Facebook, they're also international companies. They're huge, multilingual. They're too big sometimes to be regulated easily. So they're huge. And
also, as we can see it many times, that if one of these sites is shut down, this just increases this sense of martyrdom, or that they were the beholder of the or the holders of the real truth, and that's why the government wanted to suspend them. And maybe it's just fueling the frustration of people.
Yeah, well, I think it's also difficult for governments to answer a question about what to do, because they also, you know, Facebook, Google are one of the largest companies nowadays in the world, and most in terms of capitalization.
Yeah, I think it's a very important moral dilemma, and what Peter Pomerantsev, I think one of the best experts of disinformation, usually argues that simply we need a new philosophy. We need a totally new approach when we talk about disinformation, because we cannot just treat it as a freedom of speech issue. You know, marketplace of idea and the most popular one emerges and the most fit survives. No, this is an era where disinformation is deliberately pushed into your face. You like it or not, and you just cannot say that this is something that is a freedom of speech issue. I mean, disinformation can cost lives. So when it comes to the anti-vaccination disinformation, this is blatantly evident that if you do not vaccinate your child, you're risking his or her life, and even the children around them. So these are issues, and even when it comes to political disinformation, especially in places like Eastern Ukraine, disinformation can cost lives and can serve as a weapon, killing other people. So yeah. I do think it's important to, let's say, not to overthink the regulation and the let's say content moderation aspect of disinformation. I always thought that demand side solutions are more important, but most of the social science research shows that if you meet the disinformation. It has some impact on you. Even if you don't believe that, you will remember, you will recall, and in some, let's say, subconscious decisions, it can have an impact on your behavior as well. So for that reason, even for practical purposes, I think removal of obviously harmful content from the social media space, such as, for example, anti-vaccination sites, that is a policy of both Twitter and Facebook, for example, to remove or bury such kind of sites. I think it's something that is rather it brings more good than bad. It has more benefits than disadvantages. And I think it was a very important question as well, that what can we learn from the spreaders of disinformation. I totally agree, Alexander, that we cannot fight fire with fire. So the cure for disinformation is not more disinformation from an opposite perspective. But on the other hand,
it's not disinformation, but seriously fact-based information, but packaged in the way how misinformation meets us, like what Mooney suggests here, that education is a key point and so on. The strongest messages are simple, should be simple, and people tend to be more susceptible to simple messages. So if we scientists and science communicators can learn how to package our valid information in the same way and maybe add some bright colored background to it, can it be effective? Or this also raises ethical questions?
I think it can. And I do. What you can observe in most of the conspiracy theorists is that they always refer to the common sense. And one thing, for example, is that how can it be that the cure of the coronavirus is not something good, but something bad? You have to sit alone in a home, which is bad. You cannot meet with your loved ones, which is bad. And a good doctor does not want to cure you with something that hurts you, which is a total nonsense. And I think we have to demystify science and talk about it in the framework of common sense, because it's finally a more, let's say, professional way of applied common sense. And for example, if you go to a surgery, of course it hurts, but it can save your life. So it's really there can be a lot of arguments that can be quite widespread anti-science arguments, because I think the basic of science is not really well taught in the schools, and especially I think in Hungary and in the, let's say, more German, Prussian heritage is something where I think science is over-mystified. And the flip side of this over-mystification is that if you don't understand something, you can easily turn against it.
Yeah. Just to add to your Peter's point regarding new philosophy, I agree it's important, but I also think we need, if you look at it from the perspective of what can be changed right now, I think we need to, or policymakers or people who make decisions, they need to think about those large platforms, and they need to think about who owns data, who owns our data that we produce as users, right? We go online, we type stuff. Even now we produce data for YouTube. Hey, YouTube. But who owns this data? Who places advertisement if they would like to place or using our data? Very often, it's mostly platforms that own this money. If data would be owned by people who produce it, and of course, we need to think how we can technically organize it, it will be much more difficult, maybe, for misinformation to spread fast, because in that regard, platforms would look differently, and they would emphasize virality, this kind of highway channels that can bring most viral content to larger audiences as fast as possible. They would less emphasize it, and they would think about kind of slower type of social media. It might help.
So basically, it's a very complex question that cannot be answered in 49 minutes, probably. Well, thank you very much for being here and sharing all this information, hopefully verified information with us based on your research and your colleagues' research.
Don't trust us.
Well, we are skeptical to the extent that is necessary. Thank you very much for joining us, to the audience as well. And this was the last episode of COVID Conversations, the mini-series I produced together with British Council Hungary. These episodes were made possible by the Embassy of the United Kingdom in Budapest. Thank you for the support. And also, and I also say a big thank you to Edina Torian of British Council for helping with all the editorial work behind this series. Thank you, Edina. And of course, thank you for the attention. Have a nice evening. Bye.